Good morning. Welcome to Sappy Fest Radio on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick. I would like to introduce my special guest for today, artist, performer, Sherry Boyle.
Hi, Steve.
Hello.
Hi. I'd like to introduce Stephen Lamke, musician, writer, reader, thinker, worrier, dreamer, tennis player, and creative director of Sappy Fest 12 and this year's 13th festival, Forever Changes. We're turning the tables today. I'd like to also do some full disclosure. Steve is my boyfriend. And we're speaking to each other here in a radio station instead of over the breakfast cereal. And this is super interesting to have a conversation this way.
Thank you for coming in, Sherry.
Oh, yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for inviting me. We do a lot of talking. It's pretty funny. Like, we know a lot about each other, but maybe there's a few things that we don't know, and I'd like to discuss that today.
In a somewhat public forum.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, don't worry.
I've been doing this show all spring and summer, interviewing performers and people associated with Sappy Fest. And we thought that it would be an interesting show for you to ask me some questions about Sappy Fest and perhaps other things. I don't know what the questions are going to be.
Well, that's great.
Yeah.
I'm going to keep you on your toes. I was thinking about this radio program and the need for kind of contextualizing and archiving, because I am aware that the shows are archived and that you can look them up online. And that's a really interesting thing as years go by, because as we know, this festival attracts so many different artists and participants and people and volunteers. And it has kind of a sense of a library and a kind of a historical moment that people connect to depending on what year they're here. And what we don't get to hear too much about is the role of the creative director, what you're thinking about behind the scenes. So many people go in, so many people's labors and thoughts and ideas go into making a festival like this, and it's a slow burn over 13 years now. Mm-hmm. But I'm pretty curious, and I thought it would be good for the records just to have a few questions that kind of set the stage for your thoughts.
Absolutely. And I think that's actually an interesting point, like the archive of these shows and the archive of stuff that accumulates through putting on an event like Sappy Fest is almost accidental. Like, I don't think the thought is ever really like, this is for an archive, this is for posterity.
Yeah.
We're very focused on the moment and like the production of the next event.
Yeah, and I think about that little cardboard box at the end of the festival that just gets shoved under somebody's basement stairs with a Sappy Fest Sharpie on it for next year.
The treasure trove, yeah.
Yeah, but, and so it is funny, and we do try to hold on to things tightly as time passes, maybe as each year goes by. But I think it's also just a voice of behind the scenes. And so on that note, I'd like to just ask you very briefly your history of involvement with this festival, because I know you've been on the board, you've been a volunteer, and you performed. Can you just give like a quick outline of that?
Absolutely. I was here for Sappy Fest 1 13 years ago as a performer, and performed in some capacity, either solo or with the Constantines or both. I would guess at the first five or six of them. As the festival grew, those first years, it was a slowly expanding circle of friends, and many of us played year after year after year. As time has passed and that circle's grown beyond that being a reasonable expectation, just because there's far too many of us now that are fond of this festival and of this event, we don't play every year anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we in fact try not to have any sort of repeats from year to year. But in those early days, it was different. And so I played, I guess, like I say, all of them for the first five or six. I can't remember exactly what the first one that I didn't play was.
And what volunteer capacity did you do?
After the first couple years, And then certainly when I moved here in 2009, which would have been Sappy Fest 4 or something, I started volunteering primarily as a stage manager. At least during the festival, I would help Paul Henderson, the original creative director. The festival was founded by Paul Henderson and John Clater, in case that's not known. And they ran it sort of in tandem for the first eight festivals. And I would be a sounding board for Paul sort of in the lead up about programming or about whatever was on his mind at that given day, you know, when we'd be hanging out for a beer after the workday was through or whatever. But my sort of quote unquote official volunteer capacity was as stage manager.
On the right. Weekend. Which you would have had experience with through your own touring background and
Absolutely.
Just being kind of on stage yourself as an artist, yeah. which is a very nice position to be because then, you know, the things that artists really need and require in that moment leading up to performance and the kind of specifics of
For sure.
of the job.
And then in 2009, I joined the board of directors. And that was essentially the first iteration of the board. The first few years, Sappy Fest was, I guess the term would be an ad hoc kind of organization. It wasn't an official business or official thing in any way. And then in 2008 or 2009, it was registered as a not-for-profit arts community, arts festival or organization. And it remains that way to this day. So that involves setting up a board of directors and writing bylaws and all that sort of thing. So I was on the first iteration of the board until 2012 when I moved away from Sackville. And now I'm here on a sort of 6 month in, 6 month out rotation for the last couple of years.
This is your second year.
Second year as creative director, yeah.
So that's interesting to think of how it started so small and that it gets to a point where there's a board and there's some, you know, the kind of job description of what it takes to mount a festival of this scale, which, you know, relative to other massive mm-hmm. festivals that have become so, like the festival circuit and scene has become such a huge way for musicians to perform now, so much more so than, say, 5 or even 10 years ago. It's now like a really usual thing for gigging and musicians to be going from festival to festival. But this one is relatively small, but compared to its origins, I'm curious about the people that started it, like John and Paul, mm-hmm. but also the musicians like Julie Doran and the other people that were here in this small place that had, you know, a great wealth, but of a very small amount of concentrated talent, musicians and artists, and just creative kind of eccentric folk. What do you think they wanted when they started it? And do you think that it's still serving that same original desire?
Well, I know that what we call Sappy Fest was the first year and perhaps even the second year originally titled the Sappy Records Music Festival. Mm-hmm. And Sappy Records was a record label that John Clater and Julie Doran had run together in the 90s, releasing albums and singles by Eric's Trip and Moonsocket and Julie's own records as Broken Girl and Elevator and all the sort of associated acts with the sort of Eric's Trip kind of Moncton scene. And then in whatever, 15 years ago or so, Shotgun and Jaybird were living in Sackville, Jimmy and Fred, and Julie joined that band and Paul was in that band, and sort of to release Shotgun and Jaybird albums, they sort of revived Sappy Records.
And by Jimmy and Fred?
We mean Jimmy and Fred from Shotgun and Jaybird. Jimmy Kilpatrick, who is Shotgun Jimmy, and Fred Squire, who is Fred Squire.
Right.
So the first festival was basically just a party for their friends was the original idea. And it was, as I understand it, the original conception was that it was going to be at John's house, just in the yard, out of town, just on the edge of town, up King Street. Paul Henderson was working at Struts at that time. So I don't know the exact details, but it was decided they would do it in the parking lot beside Struts. So both the first 2 years, there was no main stage tent on Bridge Street.
It's a different level of ambition from a backyard hoedown.
Yeah, but it was honestly not that much bigger in the first year. it was like there was a barbecue set up, and then I think they were surprised that, like, you know, how many people came from Halifax, but I think that might have been 100 or something. I don't know. I don't know the exact numbers, but I was here. It was really, really wonderful and really exciting. And it was basically a reunion, and it was an Eric's Trip reunion.
Was there any money involved at the beginning? Did people get paid, and how did that work?
I remember they gave me enough to cover my flight out.
Wow.
from Ontario.
The very first one?
The very first one.
So they were organizing.
They were, yeah, they are ambitious. And I think that might have been, like, you know, I think they were just hopeful. They approached it with hope.
Yeah, but also a very do-it-yourself spirit, and that's where that record label comes out of as well, yeah. Right? Of just, we're going to release our own music the way we want to, or the music of our friends, yeah. That kind of thing, as artists, for artists.
So I think they were surprised at how much traction the idea had beyond their immediate sort of contacts. There, people came from, I forget if it was the first or second year, but people came from like Australia or something to see Eric's Trip play, because Eric's Trip hadn't played in 10 years or something.
Right. So that was a huge event culturally, and people were very excited, and that kind of sparked like the genesis of this crazy thing happening out in the marshes, right?
So both myself and Will Kidman from the Constantines played that first year. Will played as Woolly Leaves. We both had an amazing time, and so when Paul told me they were going to do it again, he did ask if the Constantines would come and play the second one, which we did. And again, still no main stage tent. We played down at George's Roadhouse.
So different venues around town would be used.
Different venues around town. There was still a small tent outside of Strutt's that hosted events sort of through the afternoon.
So just a single kind of PA needed to be rented, and then
small
you
used PA, the... yeah. It was probably borrowed. I would
guess. A borrowed PA, and then the
so
whatever.
So it was a small thing. Like, it was a complete small thing.
Had.
And people, in referring to each other, in conversation with each other, very quickly stopped calling it the Sappy Records Music Festival, mm-hmm. and just started calling it Sappy Fest. We dropped all those middle syllables just through, like, the...
OMG.
The usual use of language. Mm-hmm. And so then it became Sappy Fest.
And that was before texting and cell phones and
that was,
Instagram.
Well, you know, yeah.
And even
13
Facebook.
13 and 12 years ago.
So this was spread word of mouth.
I have thought about that a lot, because as the creative director, I'm involved with much of the marketing and the spreading of the word and the, like, attempting to sell tickets. And I have wondered, like, how did they sell tickets back then? How did they sell the tickets? You know, we post a link on Facebook, and we do encourage people to stop by the office to buy tickets as well. But it would have been an entirely different process back then.
About advance tickets, whether they were...
Advance tickets, exactly.
Being mailed out or just printer.
I think they printed some. I think they sold them at some record shops in Halifax and such. But
that sounds realistic.
It would have been hard to keep track of.
It would have. Well, there was ledgers and books, perhaps.
Perhaps.
I don't know.
I will say,
where are those archives, by the way?
As the first treasurer on the board, I would say the books were a little bit more intentional than real.
I mean, the spirit of that, which is so attractive to people, that do-it-yourself kind of artist-run thing, where the artists are actually right there, present, involved, and engaged, and the ones that are actually putting it on themselves and organizing and kind of schlepping the gear and presenting, hosting, that still carries on to today, but with such a larger extended team, because as you make those decisions, anybody knows that has a small, idea or outfit that they want to, you know, some creative project. And as it grows, you have to kind of, like, how do you keep the spirit of the thing as more and more people get roped in and there's more pragmatic considerations? But I would say that, do you agree that the spirit remains?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I don't think it's like all that... In its intentions and even in its practice, I don't think it's all that different. After having done it 13 years, the community involved with hosting it, some things are figured out. So some things are easier, and we're not inventing everything from scratch the way it was being done in those first handful of years. Mm-hmm. And as time has passed and it's been a successful and I would say almost entirely peaceful event, you know, the rest of the town and the municipality and the community has to a certain extent, embraced it and certainly doesn't question it, really.
I think it's a scale thing, too, as well, because it's so far for people to come if they're coming from outside New Brunswick mm-hmm. or the East Coast. You have a more limited amount of people, but a very healthy amount of people. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a demographic numbers thing where it never gets out of hand. There's always a sense of familiarity and responsibility and Absolutely. Kind of comfort and looking out for each other, no matter who it is, whether you recognize the people or you don't, they're old friends. It seems to have kind of, I've never heard of it or been involved myself, like where I haven't seen like a really strong sense of community and kind of warmth.
It can really feel like a sort of annual gathering of, mm-hmm. you know, friends and family. And that circle slowly expands to include more people expanding. Every year. But that's the feeling. The Friday night often feels like everyone's just... We take it into consideration with the programming that on Friday night, people are arriving and they're seeing people they haven't seen maybe since last Sappy Fest. Mm-hmm. And they want to say hello and they want to greet each other and they want to hang out. And that influences what kind of music we can put on stage because it has to be something that can sort of grab their attention away from each other a little bit, you know.
Right. And the children help kick that off too. And that kind of putting them forward. It reminds me of Esalen. You remember that like deep California hippie natural kind of healing center that's been around since the 60s in Big Sur area. And they had always as the center of that community was the children's education and kind of forefronting the kids on the land. And just recently it was bought. They were, you know, losing money and it was bought by some kind of big software tech organization. And the first thing they did was take the kids away, shut down the nursery, which immediately changed everything. I mean, we're not saying, it's just something interesting when you do actually allow children and families to participate on the same level as kids, because music and rock and roll can seem like a youth endeavor, but that is so exclusive and that is really like a narrowing the field of human experience.
The Kids Rock Camp has been, I don't remember when it started, but it started early and a lot of that was that John's a dad, you know, John Clater's a dad, so he was thinking about that stuff right from the beginning. Mm. But so I don't think there was one in the first year. I could even be wrong, but there's been the kids camp for a long time. So there's been a lot of kids come through that and had the opportunity to do something really weird and cool, like on the main stage at Sappy Fest.
And right, opening night. Amazing. And now some of those kids are older and in bands of their own. Like they're just starting right? Like that first generation. I want to ask you about the, like, speaking of a small town, that also reminds me of Festival Express, that amazing documentary about the train that goes across Canada with all those, you know, blues and rockers kind of from the, was it that in the 70s or the 60s that that happened? Janis Joplin and like, when you see that footage, all of those places that they stopped and performed had tons of children. Like people had their children on their shoulders as they watched those super groovy partiers make their music out in the sun. So the rhythm of a small town, it's more, I think of a place like Banff or even Dawson City and Sackville is similar, that people come and go. You often come for projects, you come for school, you come for a job, and then many people leave or they kind of grow up here and they move away. There's a real bittersweet coming and like receiving and departing. And I feel like the people that are kind of stay put and have homes here and maybe children too, they've kind of learned somehow to live with that and to embrace and that kind of flow, right? Like, but I also remember, you know, talking to many people that I've visited in places like that where there's a sadness as well. So I just wonder everything else, like living in cities, like we do usually in Toronto and different places, it's so fast. Like the pace is super quick. People are constantly traveling. What does it mean to just keep coming back here to this quiet, you know, otherwise a sleepy, idyllic kind of place? So different from the cities.
I remember right from like the beginning of coming here and definitely from the beginning of Sappy Fest, like I think it was John Clayton in particular would always sort of say, welcome home, when he saw you. And this was like before I lived here, you know, and, but I was somebody that was coming here because of friendships I was developing here and having had come through playing music, performing music. And it does, I am among many people that have bonded with this place or felt that this was a home. And so Sappy Fest, is sort of that returning home every summer for a lot of people. And then some of us chose to stay for a more extended amount of time.
Yeah, it actually put down roots here. And there, what you're talking about in a way is a sense of recognition and how that satisfies a part of being human.
Yeah.
And maybe that is a contrast, if I must contrast that with a larger city where there is so many people and that sense of anonymity is what characterizes
Absolutely.
Your
yeah.
experience there, right? So if you come to a place where there's small, you see each other, you see each other age, you see
yeah.
each other have children, not have children,
yeah.
go have large life experiences. And there's kind of a sense of I guess that meaning, that it, especially if it's not always provided with your original family necessarily,
yeah.
like we find our families.
The chosen family.
Yeah, and that kind of feeling about belonging and sense of rootedness brings me to talking about Sackville as a place and as a geography. It's a 300-year-old Acadian and then British colonial settlement. And it's superimposed on very rich tidal marshlands of ancient Mi'kmaq and further to the west, Maliseet territory. The thinking on that space, and I can't not think about this wherever I travel, you know, especially on this continent, what this place was like before settlement and before it is what it is now and how it would have been used and the people that would have moved across it and kind of interacted with the landscape. It's such a, it really grows on you. The marshes here and the tidal waters and the kind of richness of the mud and the shellfish and the kind of the pheasants and the game. I mean, you can only imagine the hunting and the kind of living through the seasons that would have happened, you know, ancient times and traditionally. So I wonder on that note, what indigenous artists or educators that you've been reading or listening to over the last while and kind of maybe specifically if there's anyone that you can recommend?
Well, definitely I've been reading and would recommend to the most highest degree Leanne Batasmasek-Simpson, who is performing at Sappy Fest this summer, performing with her band, and we'll be giving a talk or a reading of some kind that we're just locking down the details of. The books that have really done it for me.
She performs with her sister.
She performs
as well, Ansley,
with the band,
right?
Yeah, Ansley Simpson, who will also be performing her own music.
And Chris Dirksen, the phenomenal cello player.
Yeah, and Nick Ferriero as well is in that group.
Right. It goes on and on. It's a kind of a super group.
It's a super group. It's an amazing musical project featuring Leanne's poetry. Sung poetry, and it's incredible. When I took this job last year, she was one of the first people I invited, if not the very first person. She could not make it last year, but she's incredible. Her writing spans from poetry, storytelling, to more academic, though I do hesitate to use the word academic, but more nonfiction examination of indigenous thought and practices and ways of being, as we have always done, is her most recently published book, an incredible insight into what it may mean to be indigenous and how that will be
in contemporary times
and how that will be continued, essentially, the indigenous resistance and resurgence is very primary in her thinking, and it's amazing. And This Accident of Being Lost is a collection of poems and stories that embeds all of that other kind of thought into artistic forms. And it's incredible. She's Anishinaabe from Ontario, and so not specific to this geography and this land, but definitely an amazing entry point and to these kinds of thoughts and issues. Also, Arthur Manuel, the Reconciliation Manifesto is, I think, every Canadian should read. Very clear, very important, very direct in its challenges and its reasoning. And it's you should read it, your parents should read it, your kids should read it, and your grandmothers and grandfathers should read it.
It should absolutely be on the curriculum of every single educational space in this country, by the great activist and thinker, Arthur Manuel, who passed away last year.
Yeah, and again, he's from interior BC, so not specific to this region.
But really laying down incredible information about territory and the Canadian government and the history of the butting up against colonial kind of overlording and the indigenous experience.
Yeah, and his other book, Unsettling Canada, deals with most of the same ideas in a bit more of a historical / narrative form, where he's talking about his life experience. So it has a bit of memoir mixed in with the sort of clear presentation of their current thought.
He's incredibly
and challenges so
readable and funny, and he's a brilliant person, and comes from a long line of activists and warriors, and his daughters, his twin daughters, are now leading the fight against the Kinder Morgan pipeline as we speak. I'd also like to give a shout out to Simone Schmidt, who turned us on to both of those books and has herself been kind of working for a very long time to educate herself and her settler friends on really great writing and thinking to just open the doors of, like, upend our assumptions about this country. And as for New Brunswick, how about last year you had a phenomenal speaker from the Mi'kmaq territory here, the elder, who gave that was incredible, like one of the most generous things that I've ever experienced, and the turnout was phenomenal. And for him to come out to this mostly white kind of festival and lay out some, what he spoke about was conditional trust, which I thought was such a beautiful idea, because it's no longer and can never be unconditional, nor should it be. But I even thought the fact that he could articulate that as conditional trust was so incredibly generous, and some of the wisdom and information that he shared with us that day about his people's way of thinking and the philosophies approaching worldview was just super educational and important. How about this year?
Well, like I said, Leanne Batasma-Sack-Simpson's coming. We also have Jeremy Dutcher coming to perform. And I've talked about this a little bit on the show before, but Jeremy's trained in the Western classical tradition.
Opera?
Opera singing. He also does accompany himself on piano, so he's obviously trained in some capacity on piano as well. But his project is... he accepted essentially a challenge, or like the task from an elder in his community, and he's Wallace Stock from Northern New Brunswick, to return his people's songs to his community, most of which had been lost to living memory, but luckily had been recorded 100+ years ago on wax cylinders, and the recordings of many of these songs were in the Canadian archives. So Jeremy...
recorded by some kind of folk anthropologist or something?
I would assume so, or some sort of government Indian affairs person. I don't actually know what the source of the original recordings. But they were in the Canadian archives in Ottawa. Jeremy went and had access to these recordings and has since written his arrangements and is presenting these songs... as a sort of hybrid between original sort of vernacular music, like folk or, you know, community music, living music, mixed with his training as a in the Western classical traditions. He's an extraordinary performer, an extraordinarily charismatic performer. And he explains this project during the show as well. And also during the show, you will hear snippets of the original recordings that he weaves in and out of his own performance of them. It's incredibly moving. And he'll be performing at Brunton during the Saturday of Sappy Fest this summer. And it will be something that will just ruin everyone. It's so powerful.
That is a real homecoming. And I did hear as well that he's coming with his family. So that's sort of
beautiful.
He is.
I don't actually know the details of like who that is, but that's they've just been referred to as his family.
Right. So, welcome, everybody.
Yes, welcome.
That's so amazing. And I did hear him speak as well on the show Imposter that is no longer going to be a part of the Podscape.
Podscape.
I think I just made that up. Maybe not.
You heard it here first.
But he going through his early schooling and being turned on to some kind of forms of like Western European tradition, like whatever, like a classical music, but coming from his own cultural music, like having a background since a child of listening to the songs that do exist and that they
Absolutely.
That they do perform, and the drums and the kind of forms of singing. That was so interesting to hear when I heard his interview about his forms, the two different forms of singing and how to interweave those. So that is going to be incredibly exciting. It also makes me think about, I want to read this quote. It's from Rebecca Solnit's Hope in the Dark book, and it's such a fantastic book and so important, as you know, I myself and many others struggle with maybe depression and worry and concern constantly and anxiety about the state of the world. In this moment in the book, Solnit is discussing the Zapatistas, and when they kind of stepped onto the world stage, and then afterwards, also she's speaking about the Seattle 2001 kind of protests, but she's saying the year the Zapatistas stepped onto the world stage, the radical geographer Ian Bull had prophesied, "The longing for a better world will need to arise at the imagined meeting place of many movements of resistance, as many as there are sites of closure and exclusion. The resistance will be transnational as capitalism." I was really moved by that quote, and that idea of people coming together in a rhythm, mm-hmm. Cyclically here in this small place that has this really complex, multi-layered history that has a lot of pain mm-hmm. and a lot of kind of pleasure involved, but everybody bringing their own history and their own story to the forefront with them. And I feel over the last few years that's really been beautifully staged, and I don't know, I'm so excited to experience it. I feel so honored to be a part of hearing everybody's musical backgrounds, their cultural kind of heritage that they're bringing here, as well as intermingling that, but without with a real strong sense of stand and resistance and kind of a reactivating of a revolution that people are designing themselves for themselves, right?
Absolutely. Perhaps we should listen to a Jeremy Dutcher song, and I will remind our listeners who may have just tuned in that they're listening to Sappy Fest Radio on CHMA 106.9.
I'm Sherry Boyle, and this is Stephen Lamke.
And this is Jeremy Dutcher.
Ya ni wedo aline ya Yeah.
coming.
Hands down, the biggest celestial event of the year will take place on the night of July 27th, the closest approach of Mars since 2003. The red planet has now been rising earlier each night in the southeast. On July 27th, Mars will rise at approximately 9 p.m., with the moon to the lower right of it. Don't miss this chance to see the closest planet to us up close. This is Sherry Boyle. I'm interviewing Sappy Fest 13 creative director Stephen Lamke, and you're listening to CHMA 106.9 FM here in Sackville. Steve, Sappy Fest is a small budget festival. It's run frugally, and it relies on the strength of community support and volunteerism, kind of maybe above and beyond so many other festivals out there. It really is a kind of community held event. What's the importance to you about the focus on participation versus passive audience in this kind of cultural experience?
You're asking me about the audience in particular?
Kind of the audience, and also the musicians and the performers and the community as well.
Well, that's an interesting question in the sense that more so than other festivals I've been to, the definitions that might separate audience from performer and from volunteer or organizer is very fluid, very porous. A lot of the audience of any given year are performers in another year, or have performed and are returning just because they've loved it so much, or they want to be here to have all the other experiences of being here for Sappy Fest, the connections with other people they're making with other people, and the town and the weather and all sorts of things that draw them back. So it is unique, and my thought about it is that we get more out of it the more we put into it, and that's a very general statement. Obviously, that's
something that we've heard before in the past, perhaps.
Perhaps something that we've heard before in the past, but
what does it mean, right?
Well, I approach almost everything in my life like that. Like, I also run an artist-run record label. So I have always tried... I have never tried to define myself as only a performer or as only an administrator or as only whatever, an audience member, you know? Mm. I am at once all of those things, much as... You know, I'm an interviewer on this show, but I'm also perhaps just saying my own thoughts as well. Not necessarily this episode, that we're trying to turn the tables a little bit more. Mm-hmm. So I'm the one being interviewed. But so your question was about...
Kind of the distinction between audience and performer. Yeah. And in a way, I was trying to get at a little bit of the hierarchy that happens in regular kind of artistic kind of situations where there's the people that have, you know, paid for a ticket and they're sitting down. There's the people on the stage that they're supposed to kind of look at. There often is things like VIP,
and
levels.
And we don't do that.
Or the musicians like step off stage and they disappear. You never see them again. They're in the green room. They're back in their cars.
And at Sappy Fest, we don't have green rooms, other than like if there's an immediate need for like a costume getting ready for a performance, and there has been that a few times. Mm. But the backstage is a very rudimentary zone in which to tune a guitar immediately before your performance. It's not a place to hang out. So we very consciously, and in many other small unconscious ways, do try to undermine those usual hierarchies. But that's kind of the wrong direction to phrase it in, because it happened much more naturally than that.
It's always been a sense of we.
It's always been a sense of we, and it's Sappy Fest was not designed like in opposition to anything. It was just designed the way we wanted it to be.
Yeah.
And the way that it grew naturally through like the thought and the participation and the, you know, the coming together of people and ideas.
Kind of right mind.
Kind of right mind.
The idea of that.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, it's very interesting and very satisfying to me because I've been on both sides of those situations, and I've always felt uncomfortable whether I'm on the stage or in the audience with that strange distinction, and it does often feel hierarchical, and the sense of coming here, and also with the volunteers and the audience members that may not have anything to do with performance or music themselves, to feel kind of on the same level, that there's some kind of equality at work and at you know, on the underlying ethics of the thing. I think
that to me is like just as important as like what happens on stage. Like last year, Willie Thrasher was around nonstop all weekend. And he was dying to play. He couldn't wait to play his show on Sunday night. And he played it with great gusto and enthusiasm and professionalism and dedication. But for those of us at the festival, we loved the show, but we also got as much out of just the fact that like we could sit down at any given moment with Willie Thrasher at a picnic table and hang out. And if you didn't go sit down with him, he was going to come and sit down with you and ask you about what you play or whatever, you know. That's like a pretty exuberant example of like what goes on sort of all the time here at Sappy Fest.
It also makes me think of Lido Pimienta,
who Lido was all weekend,
so
yeah.
There all weekend last year was fantastic on so many levels. Artistically, she did an amazing talk where she just totally kicked it, and then a performance that will go down in, you know, what, just one more of her performances that will go down in history in terms of excellence and beauty and like revelatory strength, but also her refusal, like, you know, kind of making that stage permeable by inviting Black and women of color up onto that stage. And for me, that was absolutely the highlight of the weekend, to see the joy that kind of blew the roof off in that moment. So I want to give a shout out to her, and also because she's having a baby next month, and that was, I don't think it was a sappy baby because it's been longer than 9 months, but she is going to be having a baby, and that's a lucky kid.
I think that baby might be the only reason that we didn't get Lido back in some capacity this year, unfortunately. But
that's right. Isn't that amazing? Yeah. That maybe next year she'll have like a, you know, a diapered one to bring back.
A little one, yeah.
So we had earlier spoke about the subject of kind of rhythm, or like of a small town, people coming and going. But I have an interesting question for you. Maybe it's going to be the last one. I'm not sure, because we're, you know, coming close. But I'm very interested in the idea of programming something, and the role that you do, that you, you know, have taken responsibility for, in your reaching out to people, seeing who's available, what makes sense, who's, you know, can go on what night, who can play sympathetically together. And you're really, there is kind of a rhythm and a cyclical kind of ritual or flow when you're putting together like a 3-day event, because you're really thinking about people's participation, their energy levels. Like you're saying, the first night people are having a reunion, and the, you know, last night there's kind of a sense of sentimental like goodbye in a way, and winding it down. But I'm wondering, you as an artist, a songwriter, like you write kind of poetry, you write, I wouldn't say essays, but you're an ongoing writer and thinking so much about, and you're a really deep reader. Just wondering how writing a song or a poem for you compares to composing a festival. And if you could kind of talk about what kind of artistic instinct or experience goes into balancing bands and performers in terms of notes, underlying harmonies, melody, bass, percussion, that kind of thing.
It is a beautiful question. It's a beautiful question, beautifully asked. I will have to sort of opt out of participating in it in the way that you've asked me it, because to say that I'm composing the festival is such a radical...
Does that sound arrogant or something like that?
Such
like
a radical maestro? overextension of the reality of it. I have a certain amount of experience in music, at music shows, at festivals that give me an intuition about, and then also with Sappy Fest in particular, that gives me an intuition about what might work when best. And so I'm approaching it as, how can that artist that we've invited because we're incredibly excited by their art, how can we give them the best show possible?
Right. So that's a kind of sense of empathy through your common experience.
And responsibility, yeah. Like as somebody that's invited somebody, an artist to come, like we have a responsibility at that point that to like try and make it great for them.
Right.
You know, they're coming a long way in many cases. So there's that. The other thing is basically immediately all sorts of other practical concerns come in, whether that's people can only come for the Saturday night, they can't come for the whole weekend, or they can come for Friday and Saturday, but they have to leave Sunday morning to drive back to Ontario or whatever it is. So it's not that I don't have the ability to just put people wherever I want them to. There's all
right.
sorts of real world concerns
yeah,
that come
real
in.
Pragmatic.
Or people are playing in multiple bands and I have to consider like their, you know, ability to only be in one place at one time or whatever. So
it's a lot of administrative work.
It's a lot of like figuring out where pieces fit for sure. Like in terms of the programming, the curatorial programming. There's probably like something really interesting to draw a comparison between that and writing a song. But I did have to sort of point out that like the background of that question sort of implies that I'm like a puppet master, a maestro.
Yeah,
some
authorial
thing.
And
I don't feel like that's appropriate.
I really appreciate you pointing that out. And that is key. That's like completely key. And I definitely was not kind of suggesting that. I wasn't really thinking of like the authorship of it or that, of course, it like the kind of details that mm-hmm. you're involved with. And also the beautifulness of knowing what an artist needs and how just from your own experience, what it feels like to be respected
yeah.
And taken seriously and given the best experience possible on those little details. Cause you're tired and you've yeah. got to have somewhere to sleep and you need yeah. to be fed and all that kind of
yeah.
stuff. Those things, that's what your job really is. But I guess what I was trying to get at a little bit is that coming just from my own head, when I've recently been involved in a big exhibition with other artists as well as my own work. And when I am putting those artists out on in the space of a gallery, I am drawing on a little bit of my kind of internal sense of kind of rhythm and composition.
Yeah.
So I was just curious if you get some of that same feeling sometimes about where instinct kicks in, where you're like, oh yeah, like this has got to have a high note here and a little low note here, and it's got to have a return. We got to have a little cycle here to kind of bring a little melody. I'm really pushing this metaphor, but it's not even a metaphor, actually. It's quite like literal.
And it's really interesting to hear you say that about the group exhibitions that you've put together or been a part of, either way. The other thing to keep in mind is that like it's putting together the program is very different than putting together like a mixtape where you might consider that, or playlist, I guess, in the
sure.
more modern vernacular, where you consider like how one song flows into the other and you might really like juxtapositions or you might really like sort of naturally flowing things. There is a very small element of putting together the festival program that you might compare to that. But the thing to keep in mind is that like, we're putting an artist on stage for anywhere from half an hour to an hour, depending on, you know, what time of when it is in the festival, what the slot is. And like, you don't know, I don't know what songs they're going to play. I don't know exactly what they're going to present. I know in general what this artist does. Most times I've seen them perform, but a good artist, an excellent artist, of which I would say all of the people performing at Sappy Fest are, they also obliterate any other context within the first 20 seconds of being on stage.
Mm.
You know, like John McKeel played a killer set last year at 9 p.m. on the main stage Saturday night. We loved it. Everyone loved it. The atmosphere in the tent was like of a hometown hero, you know?
Completely
like we
present.
Loved it.
Yeah.
It rocked really hard. It was beautiful. John and his band sang and played beautifully with great rock and roll gusto and enthusiasm. Next up was Lito Pimienta. Lito walked on stage and like, I'm not saying everyone forgot about John, but Lito made that tent her own instantly, you know? So, and that's not to take away from John, like I'm celebrating them both like equally, but like a good artist, like instantly like makes you forget, a good performing artist instantly makes you forget about what you just saw. So I'm not saying like it doesn't, the flow, I'm not saying the flow
doesn't
matter.
Although there's no
matter,
kind of indigestion of like anything that you've previously, you know, that it doesn't, like you have to think about what is going to set stages too.
In a way, but it's in the, I would say it's in the most abstract way, like
right.
of which like I would just use the word maybe energy. Like yeah. They are both like, John was a very high energy set. John McHale's set was very high energy. And then Lido came in and the energy went up even that little bit more.
Or different, eh? It reminds me of some kind of strange roller coaster ride. It gets me excited just thinking about it, of having that, like all of those moments and experiences within a 3-day situation where you're moved. Like last year, I was just like either bawling my eyes out. Like there were moments where I was like really had to pull myself together, or I was just freaking out, like jumping in the air, or I was just super grooving, like so slow and so kind of having this really peaceful, like it's very you know, if everybody's present and everybody's, you know,
but so like with that in mind, like to attribute any like compositional like role for me is not a good description of what's happening, I think.
Okay,
you know?
That totally makes sense. I guess what I can ask then, of what does the role of what you're doing to facilitate these last 2 years, all of these artists to come in and have a good time, as well as all the people that are participating, volunteering, you know, coming just to experience, what does that role give you that is satisfying in comparison to the role of a performer? Of your other life, you know, when you're being an artist and writer yourself, like what's the distinction of that? Because you also do have a small record label and you do kind of split your time between facilitating, supporting, mentoring other artists, facilitating and being an artist yourself.
Because we only have a couple minutes left, I'll try to keep it brief.
Sure.
But so much of the writing and performing and administrating of the record label is very solitary work. So being involved in Sappy Fest in this role as the creative director is a way to be embedded in a community and to be actively participating in a community. And I've been asked to sort of give a direction to Sappy Fest in these years that I'm in this role. In the sense of like, I'm booking the bands and I'm sort of saying the focus this year is on this or this or these artists, the collection of these artists together. But that being said, like, I don't feel like Sappy Fest is embodied in me, even for this time. Like, I am, Sappy Fest is ultimately what we all make of it together. Mm-hmm. And I've been sort of empowered to bring artists in, but at the same time, like, when we're all here together, it's going to just have a life of its own. And the community, when the board sits down, it has a life of its own. Anyone who thinks about Sappy Fest at any time in the year and thinks maybe, oh, maybe I'll volunteer. Maybe I should get that band together and we should play this year or whatever it is. Like, in that, we are all making Sappy Fest together. Like, we're making this thing happen. And, like, I get called the creative director because that's the job title. But it's much more ambiguous than creatively directing things, every single thing, you know?
Whereas with your own music, you mostly are in charge.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
I mean, there's
so
a lot
much.
Of collaboration in performing music as well.
Absolutely. But you also do a lot of solo stuff as well. Okay, so many more questions to ask and so little time. So
thank you
for having me. Thank you for answering my questions.
Thank you for coming in.
Good luck with the next everybody involved in the next couple of weeks, which are just ramping up to frantic mayhem and excitement. Good
absolutely. You've been listening to Sappy Fest Radio on CHMA 106.9 FM. I am your creative director, Stephen Lampke, and my special guest today, who happily, I think, turned the tables and asked me the questions, was artist and Sherry Boyle.